Nobody has ever formally laid out the boundaries of the actual physical Siberia. Rather, they were established by custom and accepted by general agreement. Siberia is, of course, huge. 3/4 of Russia today is Siberia. Siberia takes up 1/12 of all the land on Earth. The United States, from Maine to California, stretches across 4 time zones. In Siberia, there are 8. The contiguous United States, plus most of Europe, could fit inside it. Across the middle of Siberia, latitudinally, for 3,600 miles, runs the Russian taiga, the largest forest in the world. The Ural Mountains, which cross Russia from the Arctic Ocean to Kazakhstan, are the western edge of Siberia. The Urals also separate Europe from Asia. As a mountain range with the big job of dividing 2 continents, the Urals aren't much. It is possible to drive over them, as I have done, and not know. In central Russia, the summits of the Urals average between 1,000 and 2,000 feet. But after you cross the Urals, the land opens out, the villages are farther apart, the concrete bus shelters along the highway become fewer, and suddenly you realize you're in Siberia.
Ian Frazier, reading from his book Travels in Siberia. Siberia is vast, and writer Ian Frazier's crossed it all, from the Baltic Sea to the Pacific Ocean, with 2 guides in a broken-down van. Over the years, Frazier's made several trips to Russia, and he fell in love with the place, reluctantly. He calls it the greatest horrible country.
It is a great country, both physically and, I guess, you could say, spiritually, artistically, culturally, politically, in all those ways. It's been, well, it's great. It's like America, it's a continental country. And it's had a great effect in the affairs of the world, certainly in my lifetime. But it's also just a benighted, wretched, miserable country in many ways. It's another way that I describe it is, and this refers to the Mongols who dominated Russia for about 3 centuries, that Russia is like an abused country. It was abused in its childhood by the Mongols. This was back starting in the 13th century. So it's a combination of splendor, really, and wretchedness.
The thing that's sort of the core of your book is a cross-country trip you took. What were you hoping to find when you went on that trip?
Well, I wanted to see things on the ground, and I wanted to see things close up. Many people had crossed Siberia on the Siberian Railway and had written about it. I wanted to do something more that was slower, that gave me the opportunity to go all kinds of different places. And I was hoping, I guess, just to accomplish that cross-country trip. It was something that exists. It does exist in books going back to the 17th century. People would cross Siberia to go to Peking. They would leave from Moscow and head all the way across that region and then wrote books about it. And I wanted to be in that genre of people who had crossed it. And just crossing it on the train didn't seem like enough. And flying across it, I might as well be sitting in my living room almost. I mean, yeah. Not quite. Aeroflot is a little bit less, back then, was a little bit less comfortable. But yeah. I wanted to see it up close, and I wanted to talk to people, and I wanted to wade in the swamp. It's a huge swamp in its western part. I wanted to see what that was like.
People have been sent to Siberia for a long time.
Right.
The prison camps are the things that we've heard about. Did you go looking for them?
I did. From the beginning, it was a natural thing to try and find. My guides were not keen on finding them. They like to look on the upside, and there is upside there. You know, there's beautiful, huge rivers, and, you know, they knew that there were good things, and they sort of pointed me to that. But I wanted always, I kept saying, you know, I've got to see some prisons. And they resisted that. But then finally, I did see prisons. It was on a winter trip, and I went to the far north of Yakutia, which is a place as big as India, with a population of about 1 million, whereas India has whatever, I don't know, 300,
more than
400
that.
Million. More than that, I forget. But it's, anyway, it's a huge frozen north area, which had all these gulags in Stalin times.
Were they what you expected when you got there?
They were. They were very much like what you would read about in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, or what you would see in, you know, what you would picture. And these were Stalin-era gulags, and they had been abandoned after Stalin died. So they had been basically just sitting there in cold storage since the, 1953, 1954. Because it's cold, because they're frozen, they were pretty well preserved. So it was eerie walking into this just totally deserted gulag camp with barbed wire and guard towers and barracks. And, you know, it was like all of Siberia really was like a prison during the worst of the Stalin years. It was a closed part of Russia.
There are some fascinating stories from the past that you uncovered. The Decembrists, for instance, who are kind of charming in a way. These are Tsarist officers who helped defeat Napoleon.
Right. They had been the officers for Alexander I as he pushed Napoleon all the way back and defeated him. They had saved Europe. They had a triumphant march down the Champs-Élysées. And then they went back to Russia, and repression again clamped down on them, and they decided they were going to overthrow the Tsar. And they attempted to in an uprising in December of 1825, and it was crushed. They failed. They were very disorganized, very romantically impractical. And over 100 of them were sent to Siberia. So a lot of what I did was I found places where they had been sent, and I looked into what their lives had been like in Siberia. In a way, they were very good for Siberia. They raised the tone of Siberia, if you want.
They lived to incorporate their ideals within their very limited circumstances.
Right. They treated each other well, and that's what you sort of have to love them for. They were the first sort of official people, even though they were prisoners. They were the first upper-class people, I guess, who appeared in Siberia not as oppressors, that is, in relation to how they treated the local people. So they learned a lot about Siberia. They did a lot of ethnography. They introduced new plants. They built schools. They, you know, they had a kind of good effect. And they also suffered horribly. They were far from home. Their children died in childhood, many of them. I mean, it was a rough place to live. It was like a suffering experience that ennobled them, truly. And Russians to this day think warmly of the Decembrists. In fact, if you go back through Russian history, it's hard to find anybody that people say, oh, that guy was really great. But people love the Decembrists still.
You spent a lot of time there, and you actually looked for and found the road that the exiled walked.
Right.
That must have been an extraordinary experience.
Well, the road is still there. I mean, in places, you can see the ruts. It's called the Sibirsky Tract. It's a road that you can find pictures of it in 19th century travel books or sketches of it. And it was just ruts that were worn into the ground. And these were people walked. Many people who were exiled to Siberia had to walk there. And they were walking along in chains. So you can sort of picture these convicts walking along. And then all of empire went up and down that road, you know, from imperial couriers to tea caravans. Russia's a great tea-drinking country, and it used to get its tea from China in these huge caravans of tea carts that would come, you know, thousands and thousands of miles along this road. And I loved seeing those ruts. I'm what is called a rut nut. I used to go check out ruts of the Santa Fe Trail and of the Oregon Trail in, you know, the West. I just, something about it, you look at that rut and you think, wow, think of all the people that passed along it.
You know, we've talked about how hard life was for many in Siberia, and some of it sounds so bleak and inspiring in the wrong way that I think we ought to talk a little bit about the beauty of it, because you did find it an inspiring place in more positive terms, too. The lake you grew to love, Lake Baikal.
Well, Lake Baikal has a reputation as, you know, the jewel of Russia, really, and the reputation is deserved. It's just a kind of mystical and beautiful place. The water is clear beyond any clear water I've ever seen.
Isn't that the one that's supposed to be the deepest lake in the world?
Yes, it is. And it's and it has, I don't know, a sixth of all the fresh water on Earth or something like that. It's actually a lake created by the expansion, by continental drift, continents pulling apart. And it's this kind of, I think it's called a rift lake. Anyway, it's a north-south, runs roughly north-south. It's beautiful in the summer, and then once it freezes, gets, I don't know, like 9 meters of ice or something, it gets a very thick ice surface, and people drive on it. And just driving up the middle of Lake Baikal on this road as straight as a string right across this white expanse of the lake is really just kind of a dazzling experience, and a cold one. It's quite cold in the winter there.
As an American going to Russia, did you find, you think of it now as a different kind of place than you did before?
Yes, I think of it, I guess, in a funny way, with more tenderness. I mean, a place gets a reputation, and then you go there, and you kind of think, you know, this is just a place. It's just another part of the earth. People who live there sometimes are really happy. I mean, they have a kind of independent existence that you find less often in Russia, sort of like, you know, frontier people, the reputation frontier people have everywhere. But they're really friendly, you know. People were really nice. They were interested to hear about America. For many people who I met, I was the first American they had ever seen in the flesh, although they'd seen plenty of Americans on TV and in movies. But I found it to be a welcoming place in many parts of it, and a rich place, you know, ecologically rich, rich in terms of its minerals and its fresh water. I mean, it's got endless reserves of that. There's something of great potential about it that attracts me, I guess, as an American, because we think of our country always as having potential. And this is potential. It's like, it might seem it's going to never be tapped. But I ended up with affection for it, for sure.
Well, thank you, Ian Fraser.
You're welcome.
Очень хорошо.
Спасибо большое.
Ian Fraser is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and the author of Travels in Siberia,